Summer finally arrives and time to go away. The Game of Thrones kills the Song of Ice and Fire. The GOP brushes off its mandate and a contrast with the crazies. I'm Justin Katz and this is Last Impressions 26.
No one ever thinks, hey, I'm the villain. We're all trying to do what we think is right. Let me tell you, people, the villain's singing tonight.
Well, it was quite a delay, but it seems like we're finally getting to something like a summer lull. You know, the weather is actually, I don't know, kind of almost autumn-like on some days, but at least we're getting to the point where you can kind of sit back and say it's summer, right? I mean, this doesn't apply to most people, but locally, you know, our Charter Review Commission election is done, and so we're moving on to just, I guess, the normal processes, as such as it is. Statewide, the budget issue is resolved for a bit. They're coming back in September 19th, in order to wrap up some last bit of business from the last session. But, you know, for the most part, everybody can breathe easy. The checks are still going to come, right? That's the important thing. Nationally, it seems like public interest in the Daily scandal, I mean, that seems to be fading a little bit, where they're still finding things, but they're just not getting so much traction, it seems. You know, when you start talking about an internal memo at Google, for example, maybe we're in a time of summer when people's attention is starting to wane. Finally, we hit August, and it's about time. How long of a break we're going to get from it all, who knows? We'll see. It could be a week, could be a month. Maybe we'll make it into autumn full on. Personally, I hope it's a relatively long break, because I've got a lot of just life tasks, organizational tasks, and all that kind of stuff I just haven't been able to get done, and it really needs to be done. And another thing that I need to get done is I've made a significant entertainment decision. I was thinking about this because of time, and this is going to, it's in a kind of laughable, superficial sense, it's a relatively large commitment. I mean, if you think about summer and how long it lasts, when you're a kid, the summer up to this point in early August, going on mid-August, it seems like you've been out of school for a long, long time. Whatever camp you went to for some weeks, or whatever else you've been doing for a number of weeks, it seems like you've been doing that for a long time, since time immemorial, right? And then you still have weeks left to go. I mean, how are you going to fill all these weeks left to go to school? Of course, it's never not long enough if you don't like school, I guess. But there was that, you know, summer seemed like this big breathing space where things slowed down, and it's just not that way anymore. But a couple months, that's a huge length of time in the life of a young person, a kid or a young adult even. And the major life decision, the ironically major entertainment decision, let me put it that way, is I've been thinking about in terms of the Game of Thrones. It's an HBO series based on a series of fantasy books by George R.R. Martin. And now, when these started, back in, I think, 2011, these shows, I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to watch the series. I mean, it would have required getting HBO anyway, but I so enjoyed the books, and it takes him so long to write these books, 5 years or so, that every time one would come out, would be slated to come out, I'd read the other ones again. So I was that into this series, mainly because he draws the characters so well, and lets the story kind of take its own direction, which I thought made it pretty fascinating, and doesn't pull back on certain things as Martin's known, now famous for doing, you know, killing off characters that you thought would be immortal, essentially, in the narrative sense. So I made a conscious decision when these things started to air that I was going to remain the book crowd. Right. I didn't want to taint it with the complications of the show until the books were done. Right. Until he finished the series, put a ribbon on it. I'd read them all. Then maybe turn to the show, the somebody else's interpretation with, here's what this character looks like, or here's how the scene actually happened, you know, that kind of thing, that limiting thing, even with special effects as they are, your mind can do things that just aren't, when you're imagining something you're reading, your mind can do things that are, just aren't possible in a medium that requires some linear progression of images, so to speak, if that makes any sense. But at this point, it's just becoming clear that George R. R. Martin has let the TV show become the driving force of this fictional universe in Westeros and the world of what used to be the Song of Ice and Fire. That was the series. I mean, the last book in the series was published pretty much, I think, in July 2011, and the series started in April 2011. So the last book started, or was released, about the same time the series started. And there were, with that one written, there were, what, 5 books done. And now, at this point, and they're long books, it's not like you're talking quick reads. These are hundreds of pages, lots of action, lots of story happens. And now, 6 years later, the TV show has passed the books in the storyline. And I read recently that what made me make this decision was I read that Martin wasn't expecting the book to be done this year. So maybe next year. We're hoping next year, right? It's just this kind of lack of respect for readers. I mean, when you're reading books, you're committed. It takes more effort to read a book than to watch a show. And you have to imagine it. It's a lot closer connection to the author and a greater time commitment, as I said. And when you let the TV show surpass the books, you're just sort of, I mean, it almost, I don't, you know, you're in my view, you're letting the artistic connection, the fade behind a sort of commercial connection. And so it works out well, because one of the things I objected to was the whole thing is called The Song of Ice and Fire. The first book was called The Game of Thrones. For HBO, for their purposes, they thought The Game of Thrones was a better long-term title. So in essence, The Song of Ice and Fire is now dead. It's like an echo of The Game of Thrones rather than the opposite. So, you know, and frankly, who knows if he'll even finish the series. I mean, there were 5 years between books 3 and 4. I mean, I'm sorry, if you're used to the more political stuff, I'm getting to that, but this has just been on my mind, and that's what Last Impressions is meant to do, is just get this stuff out of my head so I can stop thinking about it. There were 5 years between books 3 and 4. There were almost 6 years between books 4 and 5, and now we're over 6 years, looking at 7 or 8 to get the next book. You know, who knows if he'll even live long enough to finish these books, and Not to go into a morose note here, but the friend who introduced me to these books some years ago has since died. So that comes to mind as I wonder whether to catch up on the series. But what it means, basically, in a practical effect, is I have to watch the shows. And the only way I can do that without subscribing to HBO or whatever is because it's such a profitable enterprise, I assume, they haven't made it easily available or cheaply available, is I have to get it through Netflix DVD, which I've pared down. So I get, I think, 2 a month, and there's 2 episodes per disc, which is basically 1 a week. So that's actually, I'm really happy about that, because it prevents me from binge watching. When I started getting into The Walking Dead, it was just, you know, you can't resist. It's like a bowl of cookies to a kid right there on low down on a low counter or something that you can easily reach. You just it's there. You know, I just click and I can watch the next episode. So every, you know, I burned through, I think, 5 seasons of The Walking Dead in I don't know, maybe a little over a month. But it was pretty quick. Whereas here, I'm looking at a year and a half to catch up if I'm going with 1 episode a week, which I think is probably a lot more healthy. But if you think of that in terms of youth, you know, if you compare that to your concept of time as a child, I mean, depending on where you started during the year, a year and a half to catch up on a TV show would be almost two full school years. I mean, that's a mind-boggling length of time. That's, your life is not even the same thing anymore. You're now in high school, you were in middle school, you're in college, you were in high school, you know, that kind of, you were low down on the high school totem pole. Now you're a senior, up higher up in the pecking order. This, a lot has happened, and to sit there and think I'm going to watch this TV show for a year and a half would have been, you know, when you get older, it's just, yeah, you know, whatever. It's just time, right? So to get to the political stuff, one thing conservatives and Republicans have really had to grapple with is almost the sort of political success of the national GOP. You would think we'd be getting what we want, right? And some of what we're not getting is because so many institutions are arrayed against the things we want, and so for months. Since before he was elected, we've been hearing about Donald Trump's scandal. It's the scandal of the day thing, as I mentioned earlier. Which it's just the. Meanwhile, you know, you hear very little about lingering scandals from Hillary Clinton's activities or Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, having a secret ID to a secret email to communicate and try to cover up her meeting with Bill Clinton as she was investigating Hillary Clinton. I mean, these things are kind of downplayed. And instead we get this, oh, what every step in the investigation, Russia, 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 all that stuff. So that's part of it. But, you know, the grand old party, the GOP, is just frustrating, and it really does feel like they're saying, you know what, we've been telling people we needed more and more power before we could do anything. Now we've got the power, we don't have to get rid of it, we don't want to risk it, and our voters have nowhere to go. And it is a frustrating thing, and the most vehement expression of this frustration that I've come across so far is John Nolte, who's a writer for the Daily Wire, and he appeared on Andrew Klavan's podcast, and this is his reaction.
Oh, these people are garbage. They're just scumbags. They're liars. They conned us. They grifted us, and they will never see another penny from me. And that's a campaign I'm going to start on Twitter. Is to get people to stop sending money to the GOP. I must get 20 fundraising letters a week from these idiots. And I'm going to send them back now and tell them not a penny. I'm going to waste all their postage to send them nothing but a message that says not a penny until you fund the wall, you repeal Obamacare, and you reform taxes. Because they have got it. They got the whole government. They can do anything they want within the reconciliation process. And these cowardly grifters refuse to do it. And that is not Donald Trump's fault. That is their fault. They told us they would do it for 7 years, thousands and thousands of times. They're bigger liars than Barack Obama.
Now, to be fair, there is some truth to the Republicans' argument that they need a stronger hand in the federal government. Some might say, well, look, you've got a very, very strong hand in the governorships and in state government, so why not use what you've got at the federal level to kick decisions back to the local level, which, you know, would kind of be right in line with what you said you've done and what you would do and what your base believes, right? So there's some truth to that argument that they still need more power, basically. But man, I got to say, I'm definitely sympathetic to John Nolte's view there. I mean, it seems like when the Democrats want something, they go after it. They will do it. They will push and push, break government at the seams to get what they want, and risk sort of the Siberia that they're currently in now, you know, the loss of power, in order to push that government ratchet forward, because they know it is a ratchet. Whereas that's one way to sort of rationalize it, right? On the conservatives and Republicans, when you get what you want, it's just a temporary victory. You ratcheting down doesn't work as well as ratcheting up. So, you know, maybe that, and just conservatism as a worldview, you're less likely to push for things and more likely to try to gradually build to a stronger hand, maybe. Or, you know, it could be that perhaps the Democrats just promise more, you know, we're going to solve all your problems and make everybody happy. so if that's your pledge, you've got to do something in there, you know, Obamacare, you know, something like that, a new entitlement program for everybody, free this, free that, to at least look like you're trying, right? When your promise is, you know, hey, tax reform, you know, there's not as much pressure. You're doing a partial victory if you get a little bit of something done, right? But so I'm sympathetic with Nolte's political argument, political reaction. Less so as the two, Andrew Klavan and John Nolte, moved on to talk about the ideological battles. He's moving definitely toward a fight fire with fire strategy in the ideological fight. And this, they were discussing, Klavan and Nolte were discussing specifically conservatives trying to shut down the Shakespeare in the Park that included what looked like a murder of President Trump. Nolte's saying this is what they do and this is what we have to do because when you're in a war, you try to kill, basically. And I think that's a very dangerous attitude. But I think there's strategically, not only is that dangerous, even if it were going to be a good strategy to win, I think strategically it's not a good strategy to win. Andrew Klavan sort of took up that side of the argument. This next clip starts with Nolte expressing the tail end of his argument and Andrew Klavan starting to respond.
You can't fight for your principles. You have to fight the enemy. And doing to the enemy what they do to us, as long as it doesn't involve violence, is to me a righteous act.
See, to me, the problem with this is a strategy. We're just talking about this. I'm just talking about it as strategy. Is since we're not actually in a war, that is, we're not trying to do what you do in a war, which is kill as many of the opposition as you can until they sue for peace because they simply can't go forward. We're actually in a very pitched political battle where I think the stakes are enormously high. I think the stakes are the country. This is where you and I agree. This is why we have so many areas of agreement. I think the stakes are much, much higher than the anti-Trumpers really understand. But the way you win a political war is you convince those people who can be convinced. We know the left is never going to be convinced. And I think that when we fight the way they fight, that's one thing. But when we fight for the things they fight for, like shutting down free speech, I think we're making a strategic mistake because we can't convince those people who can be convinced by shutting down free speech, because they're going to look at us and say, well, you do. I just have to choose whether I want to go see Shakespeare in the park or whether I want to, you know, have Ben Shapiro shut up. You know, that's all they're choosing between.
I mean, that's exactly right. We on the right need a contrast between their bad behavior and our good behavior. We need a contrast between the unnecessarily frightening or strange, gratuitously strange, let's put it that way, and normalcy. I mean, if you think back of the candidacy of Warren Harding, President Warren Harding 100 years ago or so, it was a return to normalcy. That's what people wanted. And I think that's still what people want. You need the contrast. The image that always comes to mind, so much so that within 27 episodes of this podcast, I'm sure I've already mentioned it once, maybe twice, is in the old cartoon version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, at the part the C.S. Lewis story, part where the lion is going to sacrifice himself to the ghouls and the white witch and all that. And in that old cartoon, the jubilant evil of all the creatures of the bad side versus the humble lion who had just been playing with children. I mean, that's the contrast that you need. You need that to be obvious. And, you know, I think that's an area where we're making a huge gains. Maybe that may explain more than anything the success of the National Republican Party and at the state level throughout most of the country, Rhode Island accepted, obviously. But I mean, we're the normals. When you want to just live an actual life, we've got the platform. We've got the common sense. We've got the rational response, the adult response, as opposed to the emotional response in a fight for unreality, surreality, fantasy world. And if we behave as they behave, you know, then to the average, I guess, disengaged spectator, we're just two opposing sides doing the same thing. It's more of an aesthetic difference. You sort of pick which side says something that resonates a little more, and since their behavior is identical, you could just kind of go with the rhetoric. And the truth is that if you let the spectator, so to speak, go pick a side based on sort of their default emotional or aesthetic preferences, and as long as the left, progressives, control the culture, they'll continue to find that default that most people will go with. It's actually, it works out well having spoken about Game of Thrones, because one thing I've found is that good art at its core tends to have a conservative message. Of course, some of that is obviously that I'm conservative and I will define good art to suit my preferences, whereas somebody who's, you know, crazy or progressive will pick a different kind of art and call that good. But based on popular art that is also good and meaningful and profound, that kind of art tends to have a conservative message. The problem is that's an underlying sense of the story, something subliminal, something you don't necessarily pick up on in a conscious way. And there's so much manipulation on the surface level. So here's a good example. The villains in a story pick, you could pick Game of Thrones, you could pick Harry Potter, you could pick Star Wars. The villains tend to be, you know, essentially progressive in their worldview. This top-down centralization, excluding people, devaluing the interpersonal connections of people, sublimating that to the central power, whether that's Voldemort or the Empire. So the villains can have an essentially progressive worldview, but they're always blondes, right? So when you come back into the real world and you've picked up these messages without having been aware of having picked them up, you know, you agree and you associate the essentially conservative values with a progressive surface, a progressive look, and you associate what might be the look of, you know, the typical, I'm doing air quotes here, you can't see it over audio, but the typical conservative, and, you know, the boogeyman of the straight white male, right? The straight white Christian male, more specifically, that boogeyman is what you'll react to and associate with the oppression, even though it's the opposite of the truth. And as I said, the Game of Thrones series, I'm still inclined to call it Ice and Fire, even though Martin's basically suffocated that. But this series has always been a great example of this. Just the need for loyalty and goodness and tradition and history and individualism and respect for people and respect for truth and what is truth and not manipulating that. That's the good guys. But again, the Lannisters, the bad guys, and also the I can never pronounce it. You know, another thing you have to, Targanev, the older villains, blonde, pale, you know, rich have a different sense of how the world ought to work. Capitalist in the sense of wanting money, but not in the sense of wanting anybody else to be able to control it. That's the surface. And George R.R. Martin, too, was a big Obama booster. If you go on his social media now, you'll see him being anti-Trump. And that's another thing. It's not only that you've got the surface level of the story where things are conflict. You've got a fundamentally conservative story with a superficially progressive imaging. And then on top of that, you have this sort of meta level. And that's what the authors or the actors or whoever, the musicians or whoever it is, happens to believe in the real world. So, I mean, just recently we had J.K. Rowling and her with her the, of Harry Potter fame, got herself into a little Twitter trouble by posting a misleading video, I think, or image of Trump supposedly ignoring a disabled boy, when really you had to really manipulate the image to make it look like that because it wasn't true. So that's the author. And so on some level, I think people pick up on this difference, right? I mean, they pick up on the conservative story and the progressive author. But they probably, you know, on the average, obviously this doesn't apply to everybody, but they probably just kind of take for granted that the author has done the mental work of reconciling his or her specific actual political beliefs with the compelling aspects of their story, the things, the deeper truths in their story. You would think an author who can achieve those deeper truths in the story would have considered them to the point that they can apply that in their assessment of real life politics. And that's not necessarily true. But what it does, that sort of impression, which is perfectly natural for people who, you know, aren't sitting around trying to think of how they can fill somewhere around 20 to 30 minutes of a podcast with ideas, the average normal person, and you know, here I'm calling myself an agent of normalcy, right? But to the average, a normal person living their lives, you know, watching this, to the degree that you think about it, and most people, I think, just sort of process it and it becomes sort of culturally what they sense to be true. But you'll assume, for example, that supporting Obama or supporting socialism, which, I mean, you know, arguably much the same thing, but that these things serve that sense of ingenuity and loyalty, integrity, family, and so on, that pervades the art and makes it true. But it doesn't. And this, to get back to my point, sorry, long digression, this is why contrast is our friend, our ally on the right. The contrast, we need to embody the principles, because that's still what compels the people. Not the surface, not the political victory. You know, you can win political office and still lose. And that's because you need to win people. You need to win a culture. And, you know, in recent years, the cultural, the cultural consequences coming from the ideological excesses of the Obama years. I mean, the things were at the state level, for example, we can see that the legislators are almost, it's almost like they've just stopped caring about how things look. Speaker Mattiello recently with the, when his boy, Frank Montanaro Jr., agreed to give back some of the free tuition money he received for his children, dependents or whatever they were, and was found to have really manipulated the system and used union leverage and threats of grievances to get this to Rhode Island College to approve of this unjustified benefit, because it was just cheaper to approve it. Speaker Mattiello came out and said, had the audacity to say, well, I don't think the school should have given it, but they did, and he had a right to ask. You know, who wouldn't ask for that? So, hey, he got it. He got away with it. There you go. He's making reparations because he's in a political office. You know, but yeah, you know, the school shouldn't have given it. You know, and just really? That's all. How do you hear that and not say what? And so, they're not. It's not. It's like the people in power aren't even faking it anymore. And we see a lot of that all the way through the culture, like to this, to up to say the issue of transgenderism and the idea I wrote about recently, the idea that we're going to have public money paying for people, or we're going to mandate that health insurance should pay for men to, or women to freeze their sperm or eggs as they transition to be their quote true sex, which doesn't, is a body that wouldn't produce that thing, sperm or eggs, so that essentially a man who becomes a woman can still be a father. That's what I mean. We're by this cultural consequence of ideological excess, but it is becoming very clarifying, and you have to wonder to some degree whether the transgender push, because it is, if you step back and apply a sort of common sense normal thought process to it, it seems like it must be a conscious effort of the left to sort of leap for the finish line and just total cultural control, where they can tell you what you must believe, where they can show you a picture and tell you you must believe this is something it obviously is not, getting us to assent to asserting things that are absolutely not true. It's like they're jumping for that. And it creates an opportunity if we can take it. And that opportunity is contrast, sanity, normalcy, and, you know, mix that with a clear tolerance for different opinions, a clear warmth and willingness to see another person as a human being who may be wrong about something but still deserves respect. That contrast is going to be critical. And, you know, it's not easy to maintain, certainly not in a constant way, but we cannot abandon principle as Nolte was encouraging us to do, because then we're just lost. We've given up the very thing we were trying to protect.
Everybody's heard the latest gossip. Seems someone somewhere doing something wrong. Let me tell your neighbors, this is the villain's song.